Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Welcome in to Take It From Us for another week. How are you doing? As Christmas is just around the corner. Have you made your Christmas shopping list yet? Have you done that? I haven't. Probably something that I need to do in the next few days to try and prioritise some time to actually go out and sort some things out. Man, the year has felt like it has flown by. We're getting there though, aren't we? I just wanted to touch on a couple of things today before we introduce our first guest on our program. I got to some reading last week. A couple of research papers have just been published, and one is really concerning and one gives me cause for optimism. We'll get to the concerning one first. This would be the findings from the 2022 Commonwealth Fund International Health Policy Survey of Primary Care Physicians. Doctors on the front line. This was conducted in 10 high-income countries where they compared changes in physician workload, stress, emotional distress, burnout, the quality of care delivered, and physicians' career plans. These were the countries that they surveyed. The Netherlands, Switzerland, France, Sweden, Germany, Australia, the UK, the US, Canada, and our guys here in New Zealand. And the results, the numbers are a little bit disturbing. Essentially, these are the problems facing New Zealand doctors at the moment. Number one is workload. A lot of doctors, mostly doctors under 55 years of age, are reporting that their jobs have become increasingly stressful. And 74% of those younger physicians have experienced emotional distress since the start of the pandemic. That is comfortably worst in the survey of all of the 10 countries. And these are the countries that we like to compare ourselves to, obviously. Countries in Europe, Australia, Canada, the US. We constantly look to those countries and collaborate and work on things. And so a lot of these comparisons are probably fair. We are comfortably worst in that survey. So you can make the case that the New Zealand medical workforce, certainly in primary care, would be as burnt out, if not the most burnt out of all workforces in the world, off the back of COVID-19, and it speaks to the problems that we have in our healthcare system. You know, these results have probably been coming for a long time. Certainly that's what I get told. Our doctors are also less likely to report burnout, and only 23% of younger doctors are likely to seek professional help, which is a worry. So we've got, on one hand, we've got a lot of doctors who are really struggling, you know, and they probably need to be talking more about how they're going to self-report better, but most are not doing that. Most are not seeking professional help. Only 23% are likely to seek professional help. And clearly there would be a greater percentage of those doctors that absolutely need it. And nearly 60% of older doctors in New Zealand, i.e. over 55 years of age, are planning to stop seeing patients in the next 3 years. And again, we've been warned about this for a little while now, that there is going to be a GP shortage in this country in the next 3 to 5 years. And you can see why. Because they're wanting to stop doing a job that's knackering them. Now, this is a real concern. It affects all of us, doesn't it, when you think about it? If we've got a shortage of GPs, it's going to affect it, that will trickle down to all parts of our society where we're short of doctors. But not only that, the doctors that we have are increasingly tired and stressed and anxious and worried and in some cases depressed. This is a huge issue that is facing New Zealand at the moment. So at least there are some results that we can kind of look at and talk about. By the way, it's not like New Zealand's an outlier when it comes to the reflections from those surveyed. In a couple of instances, we're worst, and I've mentioned those, and others not quite as bad as those other countries. But these are established, developed, in some cases highly respected medical systems who are to some degree failing all over the world. Let's get back to those countries that we talked about, the US and Canada and Sweden, you know, Australia, the Netherlands, the UK, with their great healthcare system, which has been for so long. You know, the NHS, and a lot of them are struggling. And yes, COVID has had a huge part to play in that, but I think certainly in New Zealand, we've been trending in the wrong direction now for some time. The other survey that I had a quick look at, or the other study, I guess to be more specific, was about highly processed foods are thought to now be as addictive as tobacco. This is a study that came out of the United States. And look, I could believe this. I really could, because I work on a regular basis with people who really struggle to combat their cravings for sugar. And we know that sugar lights up the dopamine pathways in the brain, just like other addictive substances. So to me, this makes absolute sense that we could draw this particular conclusion. Typically, a loss of control over intake has been reported, intense cravings, the inability to cut down, and continued use despite negative consequences. This is what these surveyors have found in the United States. And that highly ultra-processed food rapidly delivers high doses of refined carbohydrates and or fat. They are key to the addictive potential. Thus, we have concluded that ultra-processed foods can be considered addictive substances based on scientifically established criteria. Yeah. And so one of the recommendations to come from this research is that we should be labelling highly addictive food the same way that we would label tobacco, which gives us pause for thought. You know, how much highly addictive food is out there? Well, most of it on our shelves actually is. So where would you start? Where would you stop? That would be the first question. But we've got to start. We've got to do something. You know, we know that ultra-processed food leads to depression. There's a link there between the amount of sugar that we eat and the amount of refined carbohydrates and the effect on the brain. Because all of that food has no fiber and it has very few nutrients. And our brains are metabolic beasts. They need nutrition. There is a huge link between what we eat and how our brain functions. So there has to be an intervention at some point. There really does. Labeling food, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, has it worked for tobacco? I guess you could argue that it has. With those awesome, grotesque images of cancers and mouth disease and limb amputation, all these things, it feeds into some fear, and that might be enough to scare people away from buying cigarettes. Certainly makes you think about it. We've done the same with alcohol, with warnings on labels around alcohol and the dangers. Why shouldn't we do this? You know, we need people to be educated on this stuff, but there also has to be health interventions. We need public health policy when it comes to addictive substances. We absolutely need public health policy. And I would certainly go with the fact that sugar in particular, as well as other packaged foods, but primarily sugar, is addictive, and it is causing some tremendous harm in our communities, in our society. We, at some point, there has to be a reckoning in this country with the damage that sugar is doing to our bodies and to our brains. No question about that. So this could be both, having labels on sugary food. Yes, it's educational, and yes, it is a public health policy intervention. Maybe that's a pretty good first step. Take it from us. Well, last week, you might recall on our program, we spoke with a health coach in South Auckland, Jared Cannons, who's been doing some tremendous work with people in his community about reversing their type 2 diabetes. And they've had some great success, and it often involves, you know, a dietary intervention, but also wraparound peer support, which is what Jared and his team have been doing. And a woman who has really benefited from working with Jared and who's been able to turn her life around, having battled type 2 diabetes for a long time, is Pani Philippou. She was in South Auckland. She has moved to Australia, but she's good enough to join us on Take It From Us, and we're really keen to hear her story, and hopefully she can share some inspiration to the rest of us about how to battle a chronic disease and feel like you can come out on top. So, Pani, it's great to have you on our program. Thank you so much for your time. How are you doing in Australia?
I'm doing pretty good. I've had a lot of ups and downs being in another country altogether, but I've kept in contact with Jared, and yeah, I'm doing really well.
We spoke with Jared last week, and he was telling us about how inspiring you've been. What's your relationship with him? He's your health coach. What's your relationship with him? Explain it to us.
Well, when we first started this big journey, I told him that I asked him if he was going to be in it for the long haul, because I was sick and tired of changing people all the time. And he said, yep, I'm going to be there even if he finishes working there. I said, I can still ring him and ask for advice. And I said, well, okay. He said, well, you better make sure you're here because I'll find you. Yeah, so yeah, it's been a really good relationship between the two of us, because I had so many doctors giving me medication after medication, and he was the only one that said, you can do this without medication. And now I'm down to just 2 medications a day, and yeah, I'm doing really well on the medication side of things. Even the doctors here are quite surprised.
How many medications were you on?
About 14 when I first started, plus insulin every day. Yeah, and that's come right down to 2. And that was that's just high blood pressure and metformin. And as I, it's been a long journey, but we got there.
Great to hear that you're smiling and that your journey's going really well. Tell us back to when it wasn't going so well.
Well, I was complaining about everything. I didn't like the taste of his food that he was cooking, because I'm not a cook. I was an eater. So learning how to cook was a whole new thing for me. And when he started his cooking classes there, that was the best thing that ever happened, because it was plain, simple, and ingredients that we've got there and at home. So when I started, I was ringing up, what's this? I says, I'm dehydrated and I'm not feeling right. What's wrong with me? And he always came up with ways of helping me out, and not to stress out about it, because this is a slow journey. Well, I wanted everything yesterday, didn't I? So I'm trying to speed everything up, but it doesn't work like that. So, yeah.
Hey, Pani, tell us about your battle with diabetes over the years, and how tough has life been for you?
It was terrible. I would go in and out to doctors. I had dietitians giving me plans, and I would follow these plans religiously, but I looked like a liar because I wasn't losing any weight. And my sugars weren't coming down. They were telling me to have bread, have rice. And those are the things that brought my sugars up. I didn't know that at the time. Of course, I'm trying to follow everything. Because, being a diabetic is not fun. I couldn't keep up with anybody. And the stress of it all was quite dangerous, because I was asking for stress pills, sleeping pills, because I wasn't sleeping, and they were just handing it to me left, right, and center. Yeah, oh, you need to, oh, oh. But they weren't, actually helping me. They were giving me what looked like to me was an easy way out, which was take an overdose. Because at the time I had just lost my husband, and that was so easy to do, was just to pick up that bottle and take it. And and that's when Gerard kind of jumped in there and said he can help me. And I was like, well, this can't be true. You need, because he was like, you can get off all your medication, you can get off all your drugs if I followed his plan. At the time, it felt like he was killing me because I didn't like his vegetables and I didn't like his desserts with no sugar. But he had other things in there that made it sweet, that made it taste all right. But, it was really hard. And when I joined up with him, I was at my last strip. That was it, because I had just come out of the doctor's and they handed me another bag of medications. And I was just ready to throw the lot. And he was out in the car park and we just started talking, and that's how it all. Otherwise, I don't know whether I would have been still here.
Right.
Because it was that close. Because it's like nobody was helping. Mm. Nobody was giving me a way out of this medication. I still fall back every now and then and have bread and rice, but it's not my main source of meat food now. I can have that and still look after myself health-wise. But, I can keep up with my grandchildren. We go walking, we go Zumba, we go swimming.
Right.
I wouldn't have done that. And because I've got 5 grandchildren here in Australia, and they're all teenagers, so you're on the go all the time.
I bet.
Yeah, so I can keep up with these guys, and they kind of look sideways and goes, "Oh, you're still here?" I says, "Yep, I'm coming with you." And it's like, oh, yeah, it's amazing. Even my young ones over in NZ, because their journey was with me at the beginning, where it was a lot slower. The little ones, they were running, "Come on, Nana, we can do it, we can do it." And that's what helped me as well, was having the support of my grandchildren beside me. I tend to wonder what would have happened otherwise. And most of my clients, because I'm a home carer, also here in Australia, most of them all got diabetes and they're struggling. They just want to let go. So I've kind of told them about my journey. I showed them the video that I did before, how big I was then. And they're amazed at where I've come from there to now. Mm. And I said, it's just one or two things. You're changing it for something else. Instead of the bread, instead of having the whole bag of bread, just have one or two. What we talked about over there, I'm actually sharing it with my clients here. And that's also helped me to heal myself.
Mm.
Yeah.
Are they seeing some benefits? Have they seen any success since they've been talking to you about your own journey?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still losing weight. I'm still dropping the weight. From 115 down to 91 now. And it wasn't that long ago. And it's like, I said, I can play around with it now. Because I know what I have to do to drop that more weight. But I have one of my clients, she's kind of following along with me. I will have lunch with her and dinner with her. And we will have a healthy meal. And I says, well, you can have anything you like for breakfast, but lunchtime we're going to have a roll. I said, we go Subway, have a roll.
So, Pani, you've seen a huge boost in the amount of energy that you've got now. You're running around with your family having a good old time. You've lost a heap of weight. You're coming off medications one by one. You've gone from 14 to 2, which is amazing. Tell us about your mood now and your mental well-being and where you're at now compared to where you were.
Oh, my mood is great. I can handle a lot more now. I'm more happier.
Right.
Because I can see the next day, whereas before I was just struggling to get to the next day. And the hope of the grandchildren when we finish a workout, because we also join the gym, and they sit there and they watch me, and it's like, well, I hope I can do that when I'm at your age, because it's like you're 60. And you're doing a 55-year-old workout. And I said, well, a workout's a workout. It's what you put into it. It's like, I said, they get quite surprised at watching me doing the workout. And they say, oh. I said, I'm not that old.
So you're inspiring the next generation of Filippos.
Yeah. Do Zumbas and it's also an incentive to get my grandkids out because they love their iPads and their games, yeah. And they will stay home all day if I'd let them. But during like the weekends, come on, we'll go for a walk. And these are walks like the botanic gardens and things like that, where we can appreciate the gardens by the time we finished our walk, maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours, but all the time talking and having that closeness with them and with the mother. We never did that when I was with my youngest daughter, with both my daughters, because I had two daughters. I didn't go out to sports. We didn't go walking. It says, only because I didn't like the way I looked, so I didn't want to, be out there. I would send them with cousins and friends, but I wouldn't go myself. And my daughter, she really appreciates it, hates it, because I'm spending time with the grandchildren and just going walking with them, yeah.
How important is it to you that you're setting an example for your kids and your grandkids?
It's a major. Unless they see us doing it and standing beside them doing it, they're not going to go out there and do it and go, oh, that's for other people, other families. You see all the other families. No, that's us as well. So we'll go around and go out to the field and kick ball and just scream and yell and have fun. And it's like, that's what they've always seen others do, other families do. As in, my daughter has tried to keep them active. She put them through netball and rugby, but now they're in teenage years. They've had enough of that. And they just want to stay home and play games. Mm. Well, Nana came in and spoilt all that, because Nana wants to go to the gym and go swimming. And I was like, oh, you go. No, you go. So, no, we're all going. Now get in the car. and it's made them more active. They're grumpy. They moan about it all the way there and all the way back. But you can see that they've enjoyed it. We all have a good night's sleep because we all all tuck it out. But
Pani, what's the secret? We have a number of people who'll be listening to this program who have type 2 diabetes or who are pre-diabetic. Just very quickly, tell us about the secret as far as the food goes. What you're eating, what you've cut out, and how often are you eating?
Well, as far as eating, I've gone from 3 big plates to 1 bread plate. And that's all it is. It's just coming down one size. Instead of having 3 plates, I was having 2 plates, then 1 plate. Then a bread plate. And now I can't even eat a whole bread plate because I'm busy. I'm out the door. We're on the run. And the little steps.
Yeah.
It's the little steps. Don't think that you're going to do it overnight. This is for the long way, right through the rest of your life. It says, and if you can pick up your grandchildren or your children on the way, that's where the support comes from. Yeah, because my little ones and grandchildren in NZ, it was them that would help me run down with weights on me and come on, Nana, we can do it. And they're carrying their little plastic things and even doing doing exercises with them. Most of the times I'll do sit-ups or something on a chair because I couldn't get on the floor. My grandson would sit on the youngest one, he would sit on the chair, so I would give him a kiss every time I go down. And, yeah, he got all excited. Everybody gets to show you when Nana's doing exercise because, yeah, I try to make it fun for them. And, yeah, taking little steps. And remember to take your grandchildren along with you. It says they'll moan and groan, but yeah, it's nothing more than to see them happy and running around and doing more as well. So, yeah.
Well, look, Pani, it's been awesome to chat, and thank you so much for coming on our program. I just wanted to ask you one last question. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think it was possible to get yourself into this position that you find yourself in now?
No. With all the medications and stuff, even listening to Gerard and all the help that they gave, it's like, yeah. I couldn't even see the scale, the numbers on the scales when I first jumped on them. And it's like, yeah, no, it's never gone anywhere lower than 110. I've always... And I'm thinking, well, I'm 110, that's it. I'm not losing anymore. He says, oh, yes, you are. And that push that he gave me and the push from the grandchildren and even myself, because it's like, well, okay, if I can just move one number at a time. And most of the time with Jared as well is that he tells you, don't look at your weight. How do you feel? How are you feeling inside? That's where it comes from. If you can feel good about yourself, don't worry about those numbers. Those are just numbers. And they faded just as fast as, yeah, I was moving at the time. But, yeah. That's it.
Look, there's more to come, I know. But, look, thank you so much for joining us on the program. Thanks for sharing your story. And it's really inspiring and so great to hear someone who's regain control of their life because they've made a few changes in lifestyle. And thanks for sharing the ups and the downs. We know that change is messy, Pani, but you're inspiring many people, including your own Mokopuna. So good for you, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Johnny Ray, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker, television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe. Rosenberg's H-bomb, Sugar Ray, Pat Monjon, Randall, the King and I, and the Catcher in the Rye, Eisenhower vaccine, England's got a new queen, Marciano Liberace, Santa. It was all of Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc. Roy Khan, Wampiron, Toscanini, Dacron, Din Din, Foo Falls, Rock Around the Clock. Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn's got a winning team. Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Bardo, Budapest, Alabama, Khrushchev, Princess Grace, Peggy Grace, Trouble in the Suez.
We didn't start the fire.
Best, Billy Joel, We Didn't Start the Fire on Take It From Us. And for those of us at the show on the weekend, we're lucky enough to see him perform that song right towards the back end in the encore. Man, he was good. I know Karen went to the program. We'll check in with her shortly. A new University of Otago study called the Next Generation Study has found excessive television viewing as a child can actually lead to a higher risk of tobacco use and gambling disorders in adulthood. We want to talk to the lead author of the study here on Take It From Us. Helena McAnally joins the program from Otago University. Helena, thank you so much for your time.
Hi, thanks. It's nice to be here.
So the University of Otago study, the Next Generation study, we just mentioned this, it's found excessive television viewing as a child can lead to some harmful behaviours or be linked with harmful behaviours when we become adults. How were you able to establish this link during your research?
Okay, so we used data just from the Dunedin Multidisciplinary Health and Development Research Project. So that's been going since the 70s. And between the ages of 5 and 15, our cohort of just about 1,000 people reported on their TV viewing whenever they came in. So they came to see us when they were 5, when they were 7, when they were 9, 11, 13 and 15. So we've kind of amalgamated all of their reports of their TV viewing over that period of time and looked at their average amount of TV that they watched during the week. And then when they became older, they underwent assessments for alcohol, tobacco and cannabis use, as well as disordered gambling. So we took whether or not they met the criteria for one of those disorders between the ages of 18 and 45, which was the last time we saw them, and looked to see whether or not their childhood television viewing was related to those outcomes.
Why would there be a link between watching a lot of TV as a young kid and these outcomes?
That's a really good question. So we know from other research we've done with the sample that excessive TV use is associated with a lot of less desirable outcomes in adulthood. So we just wanted to see if it was also associated with sort of addictive disorders. And the reason that we hypothesised that it might be was this sort of this idea floating around anyway that television viewing is a bit addictive. I think a lot of people have had the experience as young children of their parents saying to them, turn that TV off, you're a TV addict, you know, stop watching so much TV, go and do your homework. So the idea is not novel that TV is potentially related in some way to sort of addictive type behaviour. But as far as we know, there's just no research showing this until now. Yeah.
So this is world-leading stuff.
And, you know, we're very lucky that we have this world-leading study, really, because obviously we collected the data over a really long period of time, sort of from the time our participants were 5 to when they're 45. So anyone playing catch-up has, you know, got a long wait ahead of them.
Well, I mean, I guess we're talking about people who didn't have access to mobile devices when they were younger. If we were to flip forward now to 5-year-olds living in 2022, Helena, What do we think about the differences there, and is it the same sort of influence that the TV for our generation, as opposed to say the little TV, the iPhone or the iPad now?
That's a really great question, and obviously we don't have data, but other people do. So there's some evidence, particularly from America, that the average amount of time spent watching TV, regardless of how you're doing it, whether you're streaming it on a tablet or an iPhone or watching, you know, a conventional television, it's increased over time. So they're looking at about an average of sort of 4 hours for young people now, whereas the average for the Dunedin sample was just over 2. So definitely people are watching more. And in terms of the sorts of ways that they're doing it, I think regardless of whether or not you're using your phone or a tablet or, you know, the family TV, it's still a sedentary behaviour. So there's still a lot of things about TV viewing that haven't really changed despite changes in technology.
This floored me 2 or 3 weeks ago when I was given this particular statistic. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but the average 15-year-old in New Zealand now spends 42 hours a week on the internet, whereas 10 years ago it was 20 hours.
Yeah.
Second most in the OECD. And I was staggered by this because I'm thinking, holy heck, we've doubled the amount of time we're spending on screens in 10 years. So that means 22 hours a week, less time to be running around with our mates, playing sport, getting into mischief, doing all of those things that you and I would have done as kids. I look at it and go, wow, man, that cannot be a good thing.
I think you're right about the fact that all of this screen use is displacing other activities. I think we don't know enough about how people are using screens for things other than television to know whether or not there's kind of negatives as well as positives associated with that. So, I mean, you'd be mindful of anything that you're doing for 42 hours a week, right? That's your week of work. That's your working hours. So you do have things in place like, you know, you've had health and safety come around and check that your computer's at the right height, things like that, whereas obviously for internet and phone use in the home, you know, people don't have those kinds of things in place. And there might be some benefits, like people are maybe learning languages or, you know, connecting with family overseas and things like that that are probably quite good. Again, it's about, you know, even good things need to be done in moderation.
So, and the people that you know that have higher rates of tobacco use and maybe gambling disorders, are they also addicted to screens or to television?
So we didn't look at that. So we really only used TV viewing when they were young to look at whether or not they had these outcomes in adulthood. It's a good question. I think, like most things, it'll be true for some people and not true for others.
And for people, for the people that you've been working with and talking to and interviewing, what's been the impact and on their lives, particularly around those that are not going so well?
That's a really good question. It's probably beyond the scope of what we did. I think it's really important when you're talking about any kind of health outcome to recognise that symptoms may mean that you don't meet criteria for a diagnosis, but that they still may be interfering with your life. And so, you know, you might not necessarily have an addiction per se, but you could still be engaging in behaviours that are kind of having an impact on your life, whether it's causing conflict about the time you're spending doing it, or it's taking up too much money, or, you know, other things like you're not kind of able to work because you're tired, because you've been up late watching TV, things like that. So I think it is really important to acknowledge that when people are struggling, they're struggling before they reach the point of meeting, you know, the criteria for a health issue. And we really just need to be mindful of the fact that people are struggling and put supports in place around those kinds of things. And that sort of goes beyond really the scope of the research, but that would be my sort of overall takeaway from, any health research, really.
Yeah, no, fair point, because we know people who are struggling will then spend more time on devices, or they will then spend more time watching TV as a comfort, and therefore that impedes their ability to get a good night's sleep. So it's very difficult to have a causal effect. It's more a correlational relationship, isn't it?
Absolutely. We definitely don't think that this is necessarily a causal relationship, but there certainly did seem to be the correlation. And obviously it's, split by time. It's not that because you're stressed out when you're 45, you'll go back in time and watch more TV when you're 15 or whatever. But I think when you see these kinds of correlations, it is really important to take into account that when we talk about increased risk, it's not a determination. It's not that if you did this, then definitely this thing will happen. It's just around, if you look at it, 1,000 people, roughly, then you'll see kind of a pattern emerging, but you can't necessarily predict for whom these things will be true. And risk doesn't, like I said, it's not determinative. It's just, you know, increased chance of a thing happening rather than a thing definitely going to happen to you.
Helena, do we know much about memory and cognition as related to our viewing habits at a young age?
That's a really good question. I don't, and I know in terms of the sorts of data we collected, we don't really have information on content. And part of that's to do with the time that we were collecting the data when people will flinch hearing this, the younger viewers, but there were only two TV channels.
Yes, and we had, I remember.
We had a Goodnight Kiwi. So this was a little animated cartoon that happened when broadcasting shut down for the night. So the Goodnight Kiwi cartoon would come on and then there'd be no TV. And if you got up too early in the morning, you'd have a test pattern on the screen until programming restarted. So there was just a limited amount of kind of screen time that people could engage in, partly because we stopped broadcasting television, but also, we had two channels and so people were, you know, watching one thing or the other. So we didn't really collect that type of data in terms of, you know, asking people, hey, do you remember, for example, Coronation Street as a television program that's kind of relatively innocuous, but there's a lot of portrayal of particularly historically smoking and alcohol use in Coronation Street because it's set in a pub. So we don't have any information about, you know, whether people remember those kinds of things about their childhood TV use.
But I guess my takeaway from this research and from what you're telling us today, Helena, is that we're talking about older people who had access to two channels, and then, of course, we know that TV3 came along, and there certainly seems to be a relationship between watching a lot of TV and problem gambling and problem alcohol, to then fast forward with, and you just made a great point, we had limited resources compared to now, Is it fair to think, or is it a fair assumption, and I know you're a scientist and you don't always go on assumptions, to think that maybe this problem is going to be worse now and probably will get worse?
I think we saw it, like I said, about an average for the whole sample of about 2 hours of TV viewing in childhood. And because those averages are now higher, and we think that part of what's driving these associations is just time spent engaged in activity, we do think that it's possible that with more TV time, which we're kind of seeing in more recent studies that we haven't done but other people have done, that possibly that we are underestimating any negative effects that we're seeing.
I've got young kids. We've got a heap of parents out there listening to our program. Is there a magic number that our children should be exposed to in terms of TV and screen time every day, Helena?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't say a magic number, but certainly I reckon around 2 hours is probably reasonably well backed up by the findings that we have here and also by findings overseas. And I think, you know, this isn't all on parents. So we can do kind of a public health thing around leisure time TV use, and we can, you know, encourage young people to think about their use by having kind of projects at school about it, and by demanding that companies that want to stream TV here display advertising not for their own products, but saying, you know, this is a potentially harmful behaviour that you've been engaged in for 2 hours. Do you think you need a break? I mean, there are ways that we can kind of increase awareness without it having to be, Mum and Dad, don't let me watch TV, you know? it kind of needs to be, because this has become such a ubiquitous part of society, it needs to be a kind of society-level thing that we start really thinking carefully about how we want to manage it as a society.
Yeah. I mean, for a little kid, 2 hours is heaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a big kid who spends the entire working day in front of a screen sitting down, 2 hours is heaps as well. Like, it's a lot of time. And as you pointed out earlier, it's time that's not spent doing other things. So, you know, I think it's a horrible day here in Dunedin. It's kind of cold and rainy and grey, which is probably how Auckland thinks Dunedin is all the time. But it's probably, you know, like having your kids come home after a horrible day when they're, you know, tired and stressed out from school and whatever, and letting them watch TV, it's probably not going to do them any harm if that's not a thing that they do every single day, every single week, and, you know, for twice as long on the weekends. So it's not about, you know, never watching TV or never exceeding 2 hours. It's about kind of just, again, moderation, and about mixing it up and, you know, doing other things.
And what's next? Where would you like to take the research to?
I think in terms of future research, it's going to be really, really important to kind of get a handle on how all of these new ways of using screens and media are having an impact. And like I said, there might be things that are really good about how we use screens. So we're contacting people that we wouldn't normally speak to, or that we've got these better relationships with family that are overseas because we can, you know, face-to-face talk to them. So there'll be good things about our current screen use. And obviously, you know, we've got to be realistic. We've just been through a pandemic and lockdown, which I think for a lot of people, having a lot of screen use really, you know, meant that they survived. So, yeah, I think we really need to think about how we're using screens and what we're using them for, and thinking about how we can support young people to make good choices about screen time and screen use.
And you would know this best as a scientist. It's all about unintended consequence and what is happening to us through these behaviours, and often it's not for what decades later that we actually find out the truth.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is, I think, been surprising that we see these quite long-term effects from childhood TV use, and it is worth kind of keeping that kind of thing in mind, that even if it's just a habit that you get into, it's probably not the best habit to have. And, yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, it's a horrible day here. I probably will exceed screen time this evening when I go home. But, yeah, I wouldn't recommend doing it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the key there is to be mindful. about to be mindful what you're doing.
Yeah, again, it's like moderation is really important. Mm.
Hey, well, look, congratulations on the research, and it's good to see again New Zealand leading the way with this stuff. Helena, thanks so much for your time and your insights on Take It From Us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. And I'd also just like to really thank the study members. Obviously, we wouldn't have this research without them. And, you know, they've dedicated a lot of their lives to making things better for everybody. So we really appreciate them and their generosity. So thanks.
From Us. We had been talking with Dr. Helena McAnally from Otago University, and that track there is I Got a Feeling by the Black Eyed Peas. Time for us to head off very shortly. Let's talk to Karen Murphy, the producer of the program, with our Sheldon shout-out of the week. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Kent. Well, something a little bit different this week. Recently, I've been practicing a bit more gratitude in my life, I think. It's something we've talked about on the show, and I realised, well, actually, maybe I'm not really doing it enough. And one of the things that I do is just sort of maybe once a week just take a moment just to write down the people who have supported me during that week and how they've supported me, and then take a minute to go and thank them for that. And, yeah, it's really nice because it's a little bit, you know, you feel a little bit funny sometimes, but people love it, you know. People appreciate being thanked and appreciated. So, yeah, I think that's a nice thing that I've been doing to support my well-being, is just to think about the people that support me and why and how they support me, and then say thank you to them. So that's my shout-out this weekend.
All right. I like that. Yeah, that's really good. I practice gratitude too, but I think that you've taken it a step further than me, because you're actually willfully thanking those around you and probably making them feel good for doing so.
Yeah, it is a win-win, I think, on that one.
Love the gratitude practice, and we know that when it comes to things that we're grateful for, if we just sit there with it for 10 or 15 seconds, that can often just be enough just to let it flow over us, and we know that, hey, you know, it could be rain or it could be sunshine, anything like that that we're grateful for. Just sit with it for a few seconds and you'll feel better for doing that. So good for you. And you loved the Billy Joel show?
Yeah, it was great. It was such fun. It was a great spectacle, great musicians and some good old songs, and we had a good sing-along and a bit of a boogie, and that always makes you feel good, doesn't it?
It does, and it was good to see older people too, up out of this, like people around us, there were people in their 60s and 70s that did not sit down the entire night.
Yeah, no, look, everyone was having so much fun, and he was a great entertainer. The piano man is the entertainer.
He absolutely is. He was great. I was slightly sceptical about how good he'd be because it'd been so long since he'd been here. He's now 73 years of age. He often seems slightly disinterested, I think, in interviews, but I guess if you think about it, he's been asked the same questions 100 times, but he exceeded my expectations, and he was as good as Elton John was 3 years ago. He was as good as him.
Yeah, I agree. Very, very good show.
It was. And, you know, again, for me, live music, just to get out there and listen to it, it just nourishes the soul. It's made me realise how much I've missed it. I'm looking forward to going to some comedy shows next year as well.
Excellent.
I think we need to laugh and we need to get out there and express ourselves. I was standing up, I was dancing. I didn't really care how I looked, to be honest with you, Karen. I just wanted to have fun.
Exactly.
It was that kind of night, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, and it was a beautiful night too, and and connecting with people again. There are a lot of people there, and just being out with the group, sharing, having a group experience.
I know, things that we probably took for granted 2 or 3 years ago, we just now know just how important that those occasions are. Thanks to Karen Murphy, who has produced our program. Love that little gratitude practice. Thanks so much for listening to us on Take It From Us. Thanks to Pani Filippo and to Dr. Helena McAnally for joining our program. Look after yourselves. Look after each other. We'll talk to you again next week on Take It From Us.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page, Take It From Us. Scott, you better wish you some.